this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading selections from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. In this episode, we'll dig deeper into the March issue of Our State magazine, featuring articles all about spring cleaning. And our first article is entitled, Family Branches. At Friendswood Brooms in Leicester, the craft of broom making is passed down, handle to handle, through generations. All spruced up in a collared shirt, Marlowe Gates scaled a steep bank along the new Leicester Highway in the dead of February. A twisty broom handle is worth a pit stop. That was on the way to one of our first dinner dates, Marlowe recalls with a laugh, looking at his wife Diana, who had called out the bittersweet vine wrapped around a maple branch from the passenger seat nearly 30 years ago. They keep pruning tools in their cars for just such occasions. Today they sit across from each other, weaving and whittling in their studio, a 130-year-old former general store beside their home in the quiet valley of Big Sandy Mush near Leicester. If you haven't heard of Leicester, about 12 miles northwest of Asheville, you're not alone. If you have, you're in a favorable position if anyone asks you to pronounce it. It's pronounced Leicester. Marlowe's family moved to the property in 1981, and after the last proprietor closed the general store in 1994, his dad, Ralph, turned it into a broom shop called Friendswood Brooms. It traces its roots to Gatlinburg, Tennessee, where Ralph trained as a broom maker. After moving to North Carolina, he built a legacy crafting brooms as functional art that has lived well beyond him. Today, it's three generations deep. Inside Friendswood Brooms Studio, which rests on bricks left over from the construction of Biltmore, a staircase leads to a slightly askew balcony. Built-in shelves line the walls, stacked with nylon cord, newspaper clippings, awards, and brooms. Flat hearths, stout whisks, lanky cobwebs, and fanned sweepers. Several dozen sheaves of broom corn are propped below, awaiting their return. Broom corn, a kind of sorghum, has three parts, bristle, stem, and knurl, the toughest section. After removing the seed pods from the bristles, the fibers soak in a steamy bath to ensure pliability for weaving. The Gateses still grow a couple of rows in their garden for tradition's sake. Marlowe rests his feet on what he calls a tying wheel, his version of a wooden bobbin that keeps a string taut while he weaves. It turns with each wrap, flipping for the next cycle of thread. He came up with this particular design while studying architecture at NC State, Diana says as she carves a handle. Dogwood, maple, bittersweet, vine, and sassafras are some of their favorite woods to work with, and they use a hooked knife to notch designs. It's common for neighbors to lean pieces of wood against the store when they find something interesting. In a shed downhill, the couple keeps a collection that spans years of gathering, most labeled with their origin. Not only do they handwrite tags with where the wood came from, an idea from Marlowe's mom, Sally, but his dad also chose to add on a lifetime guarantee. Any worn sweeper can be replaced for a nominal fee, usually lunch or the cost of materials, whichever's cheaper. The roadside handle Diana spotted all those years ago became the first iteration of Marlowe's hallmark wedding broom design. He surprised her with it as an engagement gift. The two met in 1997 at Mass General Store in Waynesville, where Diana was a manager at the time. Marlowe had set up a demonstration, so Diana tried her hand at broom craft. She says, "I wouldn't have married her unless she knew how to make a broom," Marlowe jokes. He's been working with broom corn his whole life, picking up what his father started. It seems to run in the family. Marlowe and Diana's sons, Corbin and Jayton, know their stuff as well. Corbin joined his dad at their last two North Carolina State Fair booths and makes his own dyed broom corn sweepers. As Ralph liked to say, the lifetime guarantees just got extended into another lifetime. But Ralph wasn't born into it. His first career was as a software systems engineer for Grumman Aerospace Corporation at the Kennedy Space Center. The job kept him away from family, and he realized he really didn't know Marlowe's three older siblings because of it. So he left the aerospace industry and spent a year training with legendary broom maker Lee Ogle in Tennessee. Marlowe celebrated his first birthday at Ogle's Broom Shop in Gatlinburg. Soon after, drawn by the Southern Highland Craft Guild, the family moved to North Carolina, where they lived for 7 years in the old Reynolds Mansion in Asheville before settling in Leicester when Marlowe was 8. I remember Dad saying that in the first year, he made less than he had paid in taxes the year before, Marlowe says. It was a whole different lifestyle, but he loved it. Ralph traded his crew cut for a beard, and denim overalls became his trademark look. The family spent summers loading up a four-door pickup named Big Red to vend at craft shows and art festivals. While other kids watched cartoons on Saturday morning, Marlowe and his siblings headed into the woods to harvest handles. I'd give my dad a head start, and he would leave three sticks and an arrow at the edge of a pile he'd made, pointing in the direction he was heading next, Marlowe says. Dad always said, people say money doesn't grow on trees. They haven't found the right trees yet. Along with working in the studio, teaching at the John C. Campbell Folk School in Brasstown, Marlowe is a resident broommaker at Antler Hill Barn at Biltmore Estate. Some folks stop by his setup to reminisce about relatives who dabbled in the craft, but most are just intrigued to learn that no glue is involved. It's easy enough. Find a handle in the woods, anchor the thread to the handle with a small nail, add broom corn and bind it in layers. Tie it off with a whip knot, trim it once more, and stomp it flat. Lay it out in the sun to dry. Finish the handle with lacquer, and you have yourself a broom. A master broom maker makes it look that simple anyway, but it always starts with a handle. Marlowe no longer relies on wooden arrows to lead him to the best handles. He knows where to find them, the way Ralph did. He loved that nature provided them, Marlowe says. He just had to go and find them. Those handles were gifts to him. He would thank the trees for what he took. Marlowe is thankful for the trees as well, and the legacy his father left him. For more information about Friendswood Brooms, located in Leicester, North Carolina, check out their website at friendswoodbrooms.com. Our next story is entitled Laundry Legend. What began as a fix for gummed-up textile machines has grown into a family-run company with a devoted following, still made in the same quiet corner of Rockingham County. Charlie Sutherland Jr.'s family produced an oil that worked well for its intended purpose in knitting machines. It was slippery and prevented yarn breakage. Only one problem, though. It absolutely would not come off the yarn, says Charlie's son, Taylor Sutherland. No industrial-strength cleaner could touch this oil. So, Charlie reverse-engineered the oil and developed a soap to clean it off. It worked just as it was supposed to without damaging the yarn or the machinery or the people using it. But then he ran into another snag. A tanker would come in, but Taylor makes a motion with his arm like he's slipping something behind his back. Perhaps a milk jug would go into a closet. And pretty soon, two jugs would go missing. Textile workers were taking the soap home because they found that it worked quite well for cleaning their house and their clothes. Charlie called it concoction SB-2069 because he felt it showed he knew what he was doing. He didn't. The textile worker soon gave it an easier name to remember to honor Charlie's dad, Charlie Sr. They called it Charlie's Soap. Soon its popularity spread and developed what Taylor describes as a very rabid fan base in Rockingham County. That surprising response prompted Charlie to think far beyond producing soap to clean just knitting machines. Could it find a place on store shelves? Maybe, Charlie thought. The Charlie's Soap plant sits near the banks of the Mayo River, just off a residential neighborhood in Mayodan. From the street, the cinder block building doesn't look much bigger than the houses sitting nearby. But upon closer inspection, you can see catwalks, holding tanks, and an extension jutting out the hill, jutting out the back and down a hill. It's where the company got its start, and where today it produces almost 1 million pounds of cleaning products annually. Charlie had a background in chemistry and was, Taylor says, a brilliant man who could not take a test to save his life. Everybody loved him, but he was an unhireable cuss, Taylor says. He had the brains, though, for making formulations for oils and things of that nature. Charlie's father, Charlie Sr., co-owned textile mills. In 1976, he tasked his son with creating a substance that could break down the oil without harming, quote, the little old ladies whose job it was to clean the machines, end quote. As Charlie Jr. later recalled in a letter, what Charlie created worked well, and then some. My dad started hearing, Charlie, you've got to start selling in stores because people can't just steal from us, and this is getting ridiculous, Taylor says. Charlie Jr. approached a Winn-Dixie grocery store in Madison about carrying the soap. The store owner declined at first, but then his wife spoke up. The wife was a hardcore Charlie's soap user by that time because she'd gotten it from a friend who'd gotten it from a friend who'd gotten it from a friend, Taylor says. The store's management agreed to let Charlie place a pallet of soap on the floor once a week. It's quickly sold out every single time. This year, Charlie's soap celebrates its 50th anniversary at a time when it's sold nationwide and online in the form of eco-friendly, fragrance-free laundry powder, liquid detergent, surface cleaner, and degreaser. Hypoallergenic and biodegradable, the soap is especially popular among those with sensitive skin. Charlie died in 2021, but Taylor, along with his three siblings, James, Jane Whitehurst, and Morgan, continue running the company. We started off as this little itty-bitty local brand, and my dad had no aspirations of doing anything other than selling to local people, Taylor says. We're still wondering how this family business that was run out of a garage burst forth. We've now sidled into the hearts and minds of people who say they've stopped itching for the first time in their lives, or they've discovered what clean really means. Taylor, whose full name is Charles Taylor Sutherland III, rode his bike around the plant while growing up. Following a stint as a science teacher, he began working for the company about 25 years ago. Starting out, I did a little bit of everything, he says. I did payroll. I did inventory control. I did purchasing, website, and accounts receivable. I was Atlas, at least in my own mind. Today, his official title is president, but he describes himself as the, quote, visionary. I'm the guy with all the crazy ideas, he says. It's quite the family affair. Jane is in charge of implementing some of those ideas. James oversees the operations and makes sure all the equipment runs properly. And Morgan handles IT and deals with any administrative issues. Beyond the family, Charles Soap has a dozen full-time employees, along with Nini, a Shih Tzu, and a cat named Clarabelle that roam the company's warehouse headquarters in Stoneville. In its 125,000-square-foot building sit giant sacks, each filled with a ton of laundry powder, and 50-gallon drums filled with liquid detergent. In the packaging facility adjacent to the warehouse, the powder is poured into a hopper, which fills the 2.5-pound bags sold in stores. The liquid detergent is distributed through a bottling line. In the back of the warehouse, packages are assembled for shipping. Over the years, Taylor has heard of people using the soap as a woodworking lubricant, a rust inhibitor, and a soot remover for chimneys. It's even been used to wash out sewer pipes. Taylor's always tickled when he encounters fans, including one he had while driving his father's van through Greensboro. It had a Charlie's Soap bumper sticker, he said. I was stopped at a red light. A guy jumps out of his car behind me and he starts banging on my window to get my attention. I thought, well, if he's carjacking me, he probably would have just broken my window. So I rolled it down. And this guy in the middle of traffic said, I just want to tell you I love Charlie's soap and I buy it all the time. Then he got back in his car and just kept going. Our next story is entitled, A River Made New. After decades of pollution brought an Onslow County waterway to the brink, citizens, scientists, and Jacksonville city leaders worked together to restore their river. Along the Oyster Highway on the New River in Jacksonville, volunteers build oyster castles from concrete building blocks. Eventually, these artificial reefs will filter millions of gallons of water per day. At Pat Donovan Brandenburg and her crew are waist deep in the New River building oyster reefs, just as they have been twice a week for the past several months. When they work, mullet jump out of the water. An osprey circles overhead, then swoops down to the surface to snatch a large fish in its talon. Schools of smaller fish swim by. Some days, dolphins frolic nearby. Once they saw a shark feeding. This New River, not to be confused with the waterway of the same name in the western part of the state, is entirely contained in Onslow County, flowing languidly through southeastern North Carolina swamps, hardwood forests, and salt marshes on its way to the Atlantic. On a section of the river in Jacksonville, city employees load concrete building blocks onto a skiff and then hand them off to Pat and Lisa Miller, who stack them on mats in the slow-moving water. After these, quote, oyster castles are placed, the team will plant the mollusks in them, creating artificial reefs that, in time, will filter millions of gallons of water per day. 25 years ago, the numbers and diversity of animals that the team sees today would not have been there. The waterway was so polluted with that most discernible life had disappeared. And due to dangerously high bacteria levels, parts of the river had closed to the public in the 1980s. Pat, now stormwater manager for the city of Jacksonville, and her team have been working to clean it up since 1999. Today, the river has new life. Before construction began on Marine Corps Base Camp Lejeune in 1941, Jacksonville was a sleepy little town, says Lisa, the city's communications manager. I think the population was around 800. The area along the 50-mile-long New River was settled in the early 1700s. Later that century, James Wantland operated a ferry across the water. The town of Jacksonville, initially known as Wantland's Ferry, sprang up there. During the mid-19th century, agricultural products and goods were shipped along the river. There was a profitable fishing industry. Then the Marine Corps built its new amphibious base on the banks of the New. With the arrival of Camp Lejeune, the town's population soared. The municipal wastewater treatment plant began dumping more and more water into Wilson Bay in the upper third of the river. Further downstream, Camp Lejeune and Marine Corps Air Station New River dumped their own wastewater into the New. All of the treatment plants only cleaned the water to a secondary level, meaning organic matter was removed, but nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus remained. The excess nutrients called algal blooms, which led to low oxygen levels and fish kills. From above, the water looked like muddy coffee with lots of cream in it, Pat says, and it smelled like a sewage plant. Below the surface, the river was dying. The city needed a wake-up call, and that call came in 1995 when a hog waste spill dumped approximately 25 million gallons of effluent into the river, the worst spill from a livestock operation in state history. Typically, such an event causes massive fish kills, but that didn't happen. There were few fish left in the river to be killed. And that was our real turning point when we realized, oh my gosh, something really horrible has happened to our river, and we need to take steps to turn that around, Lisa says. The city, the base, and the air station worked together to devise a solution. The city ceased discharging wastewater into the river in 1998, and with a new treatment plant, began applying its processed wastewater to a sustainably managed forest. The same nutrients that led to the demise of the New River now fertilize trees, which are cut down and used for timber or paper. Camp Lejeune and Air Station New River updated and consolidated their wastewater treatment facilities and, like the city, used their wastewater for a land application. Camp Lejeune also began treating its wastewater to a tertiary level, meaning it removed the nutrients it called algal blooms. Once the water was no longer being polluted with bacteria, excess nutrients needed to be removed. Oysters are filter feeders. They take on water through their gills, which filter out solids and semi-solids to be digested. Material that can't be digested or incorporated into shells or tissue are expelled as waste or unwanted food and deposited on the river floor. Microorganisms then transform the pollutants into nitrogen gas, a natural component of the atmosphere. It was Pat's former boss, Dr. Jay Levine, who first had the idea to clean up Wilson Bay using the bivalves. While growing up in Dunn in the 70s and 80s, Pat often visited her parents' second home in Sneed's Ferry. There, near the mouth of the New River, tidal water flushed the river more often and kept it cleaner than the waters further upstream. Pat's family often fished, swam, and boated on the New. Pat received her bachelor's degree in marine biology from UNC Wilmington and moved onto a ship near Bermuda to work in deep sea biology. After that 6-month stint, she worked for North Carolina Aquarium for several years and then moved to the Florida Keys and took a job with the Nature Conservancy. When she became pregnant with her first son, she decided that spending her days in a submersible was too dangerous, so she moved back to her home state and began teaching at Coastal Carolina Community College. By the time Wilson Bay Initiative began in 99, Pat had been working on the project with Levine for 2 years. Over the next 20, she and her team planted more than 10 million oysters in the bay. In a field setting, one oyster might filter up to 25 gallons of water in 24 hours. That's a possible 250 million gallons of filtration per day. The plan was a success. The river reopened to the public in 2001, just 2 years after the project began. But the work never stops. With any restoration project, the key is not one and done, Pat says. You can't restore something that was depleted or destroyed for 50-plus years and think one Band-Aid is going to fix it. You're going to have to constantly maintain that restoration effort. Now the team is planting oysters along what they call the Oyster Highway, the stretch of river downstream from Wilson Bay. All along, the city has been supportive through multiple mayors, city managers, and city council members. This river starts and ends in one county, our county, Pat says. That means it's our responsibility, and everyone here took that responsibility very seriously and cleaned it up. It's a beautiful thing. It's a historic thing. Not all watersheds have been successful like this. For Pat and her team, success is measured in parameters like bacteria count, dissolved oxygen, and species present. When the Wilson Bay Initiative began, there were 35,000 to 70,000 fecal coliform bacteria per 100 milliliters of water. For a waterway to be safe for recreation, that number must be less than 200 per 100 milliliters of water. When I first started working on the river, I was in a hazmat suit, Pat says. Today, the river's bacteria counts are usually between 20 and 120, and she and her team jump in the water in shorts and T-shirts. And there are plenty of visible signs on the river's rebirth, too. Before Camp Lejeune was built, sturgeon were a common sight in the New, but by the time the Wilson Bay Initiative started, there was no dissolved oxygen near the bottom of the river during critical summer months. Without dissolved oxygen, the benthic community, the organisms that live on or near the sediment at the bottom of the river, could not survive. Benthic organisms are food for sturgeon. So when the sturgeon returned, we knew he had cleaned up that portion of the river from top to bottom, because the bottom, which is the most critical part, is where they survive, Pat says. The community holds fishing tournaments and a triathlon in which competitors swim from the docks at Riverwalk to a buoy and back. From those same docks, recreational boaters set sail. Folks kayak and ride jet skis. The city holds festivals at the waterfront. The river has very much brought us together as a community, Pat says. Wilhelmina Bradway was born here in 1999, the year the Wilson Bay Initiative began. Today, she's a stormwater and water quality technician for the city, and she helps build reefs along the Oyster Highway. When she was a child and the river became safe again, her family brought kayaks and began paddling and fishing there. The older I've gotten, to watch the river come back to life, it's really beautiful, she says. It's very special to me to live where the local government is willing to take some responsibility for the mistakes of the past and go out of their way so much to try and fix it. The community's commitment to the health of the river goes beyond the here and now. Sturgeon City Environmental Education Center was built on the site of the city's former wastewater treatment plant. The nonprofit aims to educate visitors of all ages and foster them in the spirit of environmental stewardship. It hosts events like an Earth Day celebration, programs like EcoSTEM Leaders for high school students, science-focused field trips, and walking tours. As part of the Wilson Bay Initiative, 9 acres of wetlands were restored along Sturgeon City's shoreline in 2002. As usual, it was a joint effort among volunteers, Marines, and the community members. Lisa says they just walked in the muck and started planting things. On the water, Pat and her team wrap up a morning of building oyster castles. Pat pulls up their pontoon boat at the dockside along the wetlands at Sturgeon City. She spots a treasure on the boat deck, a polychaete worm. It's one of the important benthic organisms that live in the river's floor. Pat shows off the invertebrate, then carefully drops it over the side of the boat. It swims down to the bottom and burrows in the sediment, a building block for the ecosystem above, one that's teeming with life. In addition to building the oyster highway, volunteers also focus on 5 streams that feed the new river. By restoring wetlands and removing debris and dilapidated boardwalks from these creeks, they continue to improve the health of the new. And there's a picture of Pat Donovan Brandenburg. So for her, restoring the new has been deeply meaningful. To have a healthy watershed that people can live and eat and play on lets them unplug and see what's really beautiful around them, she says. It's important to your soul. And there's a picture of a sturgeon. It looks a little prehistoric with a white stripe down the side with like or diamond stripe down the side and sort of gray, and it looks like it has a bony sort of back structure. Once plentiful in the new, native sturgeon disappeared from the river for decades. Their return was a sign that restoration efforts are working. Another picture shows, looks like a shrimp boat and also just a pleasure craft with some folks on it. And there's another picture that shows some kids at the Sturgeon City exhibit. Fish from the New River are safe to eat once again, making angling a popular local pastime. Sturgeon City Environmental Education Center ensures that the community will care for the river for generations to come. To wrap up our episode, we'll go back to a couple of quiz questions entitled, By the Way, Wherever You're Headed, Take the Scenic Route. Okay, number 2 question is, Mission Crossing Byway follows NC Highway 194 for 18 miles near the Rhone Highlands and Watauga River Valley, passing the original Mast General Store in which the community, whose name means Valley of the Cross in Latin. Is it Valley Crucis, Valley della Croce, or Valley Cross? If you picked A, Valley Crucis, you are correct. Question number 3. Popular for folks going to college games, Football Road stretches 37 miles between Greensboro and Carrboro and doubles as a bike route. Which Revolutionary War site does it pass within a few miles of? Is it A, Battle of Kings Mountain, B, Battle of Guilford Courthouse, or C, Battle of Alamance? If you guessed C, Battle of Alamance, you would be correct. We've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll join us next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening.